This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and today I have the pleasure of introducing to you Shivani Mittani and Tim McLaughlin, and their book is Among the Braves. It was published by Hatchet Books in 2023, so it's a really new one. Shivani and Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Oh, it's great that you're here. So, just to get us started, can you tell me a little bit about yourselves and also how you came to write Among the Braves?
Sure, I can start. I was the Washington Post Hong Kong and Southeast Asia bureau chief at the time. Moved. Tim and I are married. No spoilers there. we moved to Hong Kong in 2018, and our roles were meant to be regional at the time, both of us. But, you know, very quickly, I think we sensed that things were changing in Hong Kong, right? That was the year that the West Kowloon Railway Station was completed and opened. The bridge connecting Hong Kong to Zhuhai and Macau was also opened. It there was a sense of encouragement already sort of happening and slow drumbeat of that. And then, obviously, the events of 2019 happened. And when they did, you know, I think our focus, with the Washington Post, meant to be sort of regional, meant to look at the region, that changed completely, right? With such a big news event in Hong Kong, our focus totally shifted to covering the protests day in and day out, spending the Sundays on the streets and then trying to make sense of everything that happened in the weekdays. And it sort of followed that rhythm until COVID hit and things went quiet. And then within a few months, the national security law was passed. So, speaking for the both of us here, but just in a quick summary, I think, you know, there was a sense that things were really unfinished. And we felt that, you know, with a bit of more research and sort of going back into history, we can sort of contextualize what we saw in 2019 and, you know, kind of bring a certain amount of context and help to it by pursuing a book.
Yes, and for myself, I'd be 2018. Just started working for The Atlantic. I was freelancing a little bit before then. I wasn't really writing so much about Hong Kong in the beginning. I was living there, but I was kind of doing regional stuff, much like Shivani. I think that the first, you know, article I wrote for The Atlantic on Hong Kong was about the bridge opening and going over there observing that process, and it was kind of a big deal at the time. Much like Shivani, I was that regional stuff kind of came to a halt, and I focused mostly primarily on Hong Kong for the next few years. You know, first the protests and what followed, and then of course, you know, the pandemic made its way to Hong Kong pretty quickly, more so probably before it hit the US and Europe. So that kind of took over our lives after that, and then they kind of melded together in a lot of ways.
I found the research in your book like super interesting because it was so rich and so detailed, and you could really tell that you were on the ground, and you know, it was so much of it was based on your day-to-day experiences and your reporting. Can you tell me a little bit about how you did the research and how that informed the book?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we can break it into a few different kind of like categories. I think, you know, the on the ground stuff was just, with Shivani and I mostly together, you know, going out to the protests pretty much, every weekend, the big kind of marches, they tend to happen on Saturdays and particularly Sundays. The smaller marches during the week, you know, I think we really made an effort to try to be at as many as possible, to kind of hang out at them as long as possible until we needed to kind of rush back to file things, to try to just absorb as much as what was going on. You know, we shot a lot of, you know, videos for our own reporting, not really for broadcast. interviewed as many people as possible. So I think, you know, the weekend was kind of this flurry of going out and reporting. The week was kind of smaller protests, and then talking to kind of a lot of academics and lawmakers, you know, both in Hong Kong and the U.S., trying to kind of sort out what was going on. So it kind of had a bit of a rhythm to it, actually, after a while, even though it seemed kind of like maybe, especially towards the end, a bit chaotic. To us, I think it felt kind of, it felt like there was a bit of a rhythm going there for a while. So I mean, I think that's where a lot of the on the reporting ground from us came from. I think, luckily, also, you know, the situation of Hong Kong, you know, because of the universities there and the academics there, a lot of this stuff, 2019 was kind of being studied by a lot of people from an academic angle, kind of in real time. So that was really helpful. Like the polling, the opinion polls, that kind of stuff that was coming out like almost the days after this stuff happened, was we really got to have a real-time read on what was happening. And that kind of stuff had taken place during other protest movements as well in 2014 and 2003. So there really was like a lot of stuff to go look back on, you know, as well. There was, you know, academic resources, of course, like news clippings. So there was a whole lot of stuff, too much stuff. It did not make it in. We kept buying books and going further into archives. But yeah, I mean, that was really fun and I think really interesting part of reporting as well.
And I think just to add to that, I mean, the some of the key things we really wanted to report out and made sure that we used the space, right, that happened between the events and when we started writing the book to do was three things. One was the lead up to the extradition bill itself. I think we reported that out in quite a bit of granularity because a lot of people were actually, including from the probation camp, willing to talk about what happened and what went wrong. I mean, they were willing to admit that there were so many off-ramps that could have been taken all the way up to June of 2019, right? And I think, you know, we tried to document that sort of step by step, including from interviews with people inside the establishment. And then once the protests happened, a few key events were quite defining, right? The July 1st break-in of the Legislative Council, Yuen Long, and what happened there on July 21st. I think those we considered sort of major kind of touchstones that really changed the sort of kind of rhythm of the protest and also really showed that people were much more open to kind of direct action and action that people would have considered violent, right, back in 2014 or back in 2003. And so, you know, going back and understanding that was quite important for us as well.
That's really interesting. So I want to ask you, was there anything that surprised you when you were reporting on the protests, like in terms of the way the movement changed, or as you said just now, it changed when there was sort of violence that in, say, 2003 would not have been tolerated or sort of accepted by the wider community? What surprised you in reporting?
Yeah, I think one of the things that was so interesting, because, you know, our book goes back to 1989, right? And actually looks at the start of the birth of the modern pro-democracy, you know, movement and sort of tracks this evolution through 2003, 2014, and then 2019 using these key characters, right? I mean, one of the things that continues to surprise me today and was something that came up also in my reporting at the time was really this growing sort of acceptance of more radical action, right? In most countries in the world, when you see people start throwing Molotov cocktails and so on, that's when you see a sort of dipping of sort of popular support, which kind of never happened, right, in Hong Kong. And I think, you know, we tried to use our main characters in the book to understand why young people who were even sort of apathetic back in, you know, 2014, or sort of on the fringes of all this stuff, would then themselves, you know, finding their way towards more radical and more violent actions, right? And sort of willing to do, you know, things that they could have never anticipated doing even a year before that, right? And I think that sort of continues to surprise me. And it was something we sort of tried to spend a lot of time understanding, right? Including by looking at other movements throughout history and how radicalization happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was certainly something they were interested in. I mean, I think, you know, again, looking at it kind of anecdotally, when we talked to and told the story through, and also the research showed that people were really, you know, maybe not they understood why people were taking those actions, right? Even if they didn't maybe agree with them. And I think that's an interesting thing to kind of think about and also differentiate from saying that they were, you know, that they were behind it. I mean, maybe they weren't behind it, believing in it, but they understood why other people would have gone that direction, right? So I think that was for us kind of interesting one to see. I think if we're looking at not maybe so much the movement, but the government's kind of reaction to it, I think it was also kind of interesting to see how this grew from what was really kind of, I think, a local governance kind of problem into a very big problem for Beijing, and how that changed the way people talked about it or reacted to it. Especially from officials in the government and lawmakers at that time. I think those were kind of things that jumped out to us that were really, you know, interesting, aside from kind of just the characters, just the stuff just you kind of meet along the way. I think every protest, there was, you know, people who told you a story or who you saw or had a funny sign or things like that. There was these kind of teeny little things, you know, that happened along the way, that also kind of make every part of reporting on a big movement like this fascinating, you know, undertaking.
So maybe it's a good time to talk about some of your main characters in the book and some of the other characters that you met in the protest. This is one of definitely my favorite parts of the book, because, you know, I've read loads about the protests and, you know, I was in Hong Kong at the time. But this, like, exploring the protests through the eyes of these protagonists that you had, really made it more real for me, but also I was able to understand different aspects and different sides to what was going on that I could never have experienced. So perhaps you can tell me about some of these characters in your book and some of the others that you met as well.
Sure. Well, so I'll do two and two, I guess. I'll take the first ones. So the first person I think that is Reverend Chu, which you named, a guy who has been involved in the pro-democracy movement really from its start. You know, he's in his 80s now and has kind of a history that mirrors a lot of the people, you know, in Hong Kong. He was born in Hong Kong, moved to the mainland, you know, was there for parts of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, moved back to Hong Kong, and it's essentially an economic migrant. Saw the city change and develop, and through his dealings with the church is kind of how he got involved in the pro-democracy movement, and ended up kind of becoming, you know, a massive part of his life. So with him, we wanted to use him to talk a little bit about the history and the arc of all this stuff. And I think it was also, you know, he's one of those people that was just at so many key moments. I think Giovanni and I, every time we interviewed him, which is many, many times, he would kind of add like, oh, I knew this person, or I was there when this happened. And then it would just start like another conversation about something, right? Even when you look at all photos of important moments in Hong Kong, if you just look behind like the Martin Lees and the Jimmy Lai, he's often there, right? Like kind of right there in all the mix. So, you know, we wanted to use him to kind of tell this history bit of the development of Hong Kong, Hong Kong's identity, you know, as it was kind of being separated from the mainland in a way. And then the other person who I guess I'll talk about is Finn Lau, who's from a very different kind of generation of activists. You know, he was an anonymous person during the movement, right up until the end. And he was living in London, though he's from Hong Kong, and he was using the internet to write these manifestos and kind of propel the movement forward through kind of message boards. And I think, you know, that's a very different, you know, experience with the pro-democracy movement, with the protest movement. You know, specifically, I think we wanted to talk to him a little bit because he spoke a lot or kind of detailed, you know, what can be done online in a leaderless movement, like, but also, you know, what can be accomplished, but also, you know, are there limitations of that? You know, how far can that go? I think those are two people from like very different generations. So I think, and they both kind of told different aspects of Hong Kong's story. And I'll let Shivani tackle a little too, so I don't ramble on.
One of the things we really wanted to do while giving, you know, having Reverend Chu sort of be the anchor of the book, right, because his life obviously spans the longest time, was the center of the book around young people, right, because young people were really sort of at the front and center of 2019 and sort of the front and center of this sort of great disappointment, right, in Hong Kong. And I think Tommy, for us, sort of fits that in a big way. You know, he, somebody who grew up in public housing, you know, really felt very disillusioned with the idea that Hong Kong could be a place where he saw himself buy a car or own a home or get married, right? Like the Hong Kong sort of dream as it sold is something that never really applied to him. But he was a visual arts student, you know, that was the way he expressed himself. And when the extradition bill was sort of discussed, right, I think he saw it as an affront to sort of the kind of liberal sort of values he wanted to see in Hong Kong. So he gets into the movement that way and steadily becomes more and more kind of radicalized. You know, our book is called Among the Braves. I think Tommy is probably the only one who fits that, the word the Braves, right, which is in Hong Kong, you know, what they refer to as the most frontline protesters would go out every day and sort of fight the police and extinguish tear gas and so on. So we track his journey from sort of being a kind of apathetic class clown to becoming a quote unquote brave, and then essentially flees to Taiwan, where he spends 6 months in detention before being resettled in the US. And our last sort of protagonist character is Gwyneth Ho. She was a journalist at the time that the protest started, actually was studying in Denmark, and then comes back for a summer, where essentially the trajectory of her whole life changes because of what happens to her in Yuen on July the 21st. And she ends up, you know, trying to kind of harness, you know, what had sort of happened to her to become a political activist, really, and is one of the 47 charged in the big national security law case and has been jailed since the start of 2021.
Yeah.
So I want to pick up on something you've just sort of referenced in relation to Hong Kong identity and the sort of separation from the mainland, and especially sort of considering it from the perspective of Hong Kong's youth. You know, I want to ask you sort of in 2019, do you think it sort of shaped what it was to be a Hong Konger in terms of a sort of, I don't know if you can say national identity, but sort of a, you know, very specific sort of national character?
Yeah, I think that was like slowly building, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's something that we saw in 89, the political consciousness was built alongside that consciousness that was developing in Beijing, right? It went hand in hand. I mean, I think people saw themselves for the first time as Chinese and felt a lot of solidarity with what that meant, right? It meant sort of, you know, pushing for your rights. It meant sort of protest, right? And then when that was crushed, that generation felt, you know, very strongly about continuing that legacy, right, of what was started in Beijing in 1989. And so much of the early pro-democracy movement focused so much, right, on this dream of democratization in China. But by the time we reach 2019, right, that's sort of over, right, with that new generation of young people. I mean, they don't really see themselves being concerned with that in the least. And for them, the sort of defining thing was 2014. For Tommy in particular, it was localism and the rise of Edward Leung and the rise of this idea of what it meant to be a Hong Konger in those terms. And I think that drove to them so much of, you know, why they participated in 2019, right? It was this feeling of like, if we're not on the streets, if we're not fighting, if we're not doing something, then like we're not Hong Kongers, right? And I think, you know, that was something that permeated throughout our conversations. It wasn't like, nobody said like we really wanted to do this. They said we felt we had to. It was always that word, right? I felt I had to. I had no choice. I had to. And I think that ties in so strongly with that sense of identity and that sense of how they saw themselves and how they saw their role in kind of defending the city at the time that this was happening, right? And you also saw it manifested in things like Glory to Hong Kong. You know, I'm borrowing from somebody else who said this, right? But if they said, you know, if 2014 was the birth of a political consciousness in Hong Kong, you know, 2019 was the birth of a Hong Kong nation, right? That national identity, even without the context of a nation. And that's not to mean independence, but, you know, identity without that state.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS. You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, and I think you can see now it's becoming more clear, you know, when the national security law came, not to jump ahead too far much here, but when the national security law came and now with Article 23, the domestic national security law that we just got kind of the outline of earlier today, you're seeing that this wasn't, you know, these laws weren't just obviously about stopping, you know, the protest or stopping violence as they once said. You can see much more clearly now that it was about this. There is part of it about breaking this identity, about kind of pushing down this hung identity or erasing it. And in the document today released by the government on Article 23, they quote, you know, the phrase nation building as something that they saw happening in 2019. It's now unacceptable, right? And they list that along with, you know, terrorism and separatism and independence is this phrase nation building, right? So that, I think, shows you how seriously perturbed the government has become by the fact that this Hong Kong identity took root so strongly, and the people didn't identify as Chinese, which I think obviously the government thought would happen post 1997, right? That that there would be this great, you know, Chinese identity that would take over within Hong Kong.
And so my next question then is, you know, the second part of the book is titled Burn With Us. And this is one of the sort of catchphrases of the protest movement. If we burn, you burn with us. So how did this sort of inform national identity, you know, or this specific Hong Konger identity? You just said that when you spoke to people, they had this sense that they had to fight, they had to go out on the streets. So, you know, what did this mean if we burn, you burn with us?
Yeah, I think it was this idea that, like, if this really fatalistic thing would have happened, right? I mean, if you're powerless in any other way, right? The government is doing all the stuff, the police is doing all the stuff, you're standing up to China, which is this, like, unmovable entity, then the only thing that's within your power to do is sort of take things down with you as they're sort of trying to kind of demolish what you care about, right? Which is the sort of identity and the freedoms and the liberties and so on and so forth. And so it is this sense that, like, you know, all the things that China wants from Hong Kong, right? Using it as a financial center, using it as a place where capital flows can happen, you know, helping it sort of bolster the Chinese economy, the relationship, right, between the US and China that for so long, right, happened through Hong Kong. That should be targeted as well. And, you know, this wasn't just sort of a theoretical thing. I mean, it really manifested itself with so much of the protest movement, whether it was in Hong Kong or outside of Hong Kong, focused on sanctions and passing sanctions and trying to get Hong Kong to sort of be a sort of quote-unquote pariah, right, in the way that, like, you know, Carrie Lam is now sanctioned and John Lee is sanctioned, right? That was something that they directly were sort of hoping for as a result of that, right? And that Hong Kong should no longer be considered this, you know, glamorous international financial center. It should be punished because it was punishing its own people.
And sort of at the time, almost foreshadowing what was to come in 2019, you know, you just mentioned Carrie Lam. So she was the chief executive in 2019 during the protests. She was chosen to become chief executive in 2017. And this is one of the chapters in your book. You describe her as the leader who killed her city. So when she was made chief executive, she said, "My priority will be to heal the divide and to ease the frustration and to unite our society to move forward, to uphold the values of inclusiveness, freedoms of the press and of speech, respect from human rights, and systems which have taken generations to establish, such as the independent judiciary, rule of law, and clean government." Yet that same night, when she was sort of sworn in as chief executive, Xi Jinping, who was also there, warned that any attempt to endanger China's sovereignty and security challenges the power of the central government or uses Hong Kong to carry out infiltration and sabotage against the mainland is an act that crosses the red line. So perhaps can you tell me, expand upon perhaps a little bit, these sort of seeming competing tensions in the sort of normative framework of governance leading up to 2019 and then after?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those kind of two quotes sort of, in a way, describe the difficulties and the tensions that are inherent in being a chief executive of Hong Kong, right? You have kind of two distinct constituencies that you're working for here. You have the people of Hong Kong, who are, we know through district council elections and polling, predominantly, pro-democracy leaning. There's British-style court system that they're used to. There's an openness of governance that people have grown accustomed to of getting internationalness that doesn't exist, on the mainland, right? And the question I think is always for the leaders of Hong Kong is kind of which, or it's obvious in which party they're going to favor, which is Beijing, because that's who put them in the position. But I guess the question is then, to what degree kind of will you favor Beijing, and how will you thread that needle or walk that line? And I think Carrie Lam was uniquely bad at that job, although it should be said that everyone that's come before Carrie Lam has pretty much also sort of failed at this position, right? Tung Chee Hwa was stepped down citing health concerns, though we know that he stayed around in the public eye for many, many years after, following the 2003 protests. Donald Chung went to jail for corruption. And Siwai Long was, yanked out of running for a second term of roughly leading the way for Carrie Lam, right? So none of these people have been particularly good at the job. And she was uniquely bad of the lot, right? I think and that is due a lot to the position, but also her personality, which we know through a lot of reporting. She's very stubborn and hard-headed. I think she alienated tons of people, in Hong Kong. A common refrain that I heard even from pro-Beijing officials when I spoke about Carrie Lam was that you can count on your hand the number of friends she has, somewhere between 3 and 5 people that actually enjoy being around her. In the beginning of her term, I think there's also this international constituency in Hong Kong of the chambers of commerce and the businessmen who do have an outsized kind of sway, I think, in the city's governance. And they liked her, right? She was very good with numbers. She was very kind of, she could answer their questions very well. She was kind of quick-witted in conversations with them. If you look back when she was doing these international kind of events and things like that. So I think they were lulled a little bit into believing that she could kind of right this ship and kind of focus on the economy, get things going again. And then really when the issues started piling up for her, and particularly, the protest movement started, she just kept plowing ahead and missed all of these, off ramps and missed all these opportunities to diffuse the situation. To go back to your quote, that you started with, that's kind of what we heard, what she said, and is what kind of we hear now about what happened in Hong Kong in 2019, right? That it became this base of subversion and, it was a color revolution, is a phrase that we hear a lot now. And, whenever I hear that or look at the government statements, so you always look back to see kind of why these things started, which they never give, in the government statements now, these protests just materialized out of thin air, right? There was no impetus towards it. And there was this law, and there was Carrie Lam, and there was John Lee pushing it forward. And they're the ones who caused this. So I think that's kind of a good thing for listeners or anybody looking at Hong Kong to remember that they're the ones responsible.
So then why do you think Beijing saw Hong Kong as such a threat to sort of political stability?
Yeah, I think that was one of the things we really found quite revelatory when we were reporting this book, right? So this starts off as a local issue, pushed by Carrie Lam, it's pushed by John Lee. Beijing isn't really too concerned one way or another. But then as it gains steam and gains momentum, right? And this, again, remember, was the Trump era. The U.S. really piggybacks on it in a big way. And there is this sort of like mutual kind of appeal on both sides, right? Obviously, the Hong Kong, democracy movement very, very, and historically has been very close to Washington and London and other governments, right? And that is a relationship that goes back, even from the Martin Lee era, and something that has always grated on both the Hong Kong government and Beijing. But then you also see people like, Mike Pompeo and, you know, Josh Hawley and others from kind of the Republican Party picking up Hong Kong as this big like cause or big kind of part of sort of their politicking within the US as well. And I think those confluence of events, especially when things started getting more violent on the streets, when these American like senators and stuff started appearing, I think they really couldn't not believe that this was a US plot or subversion. Even if the Hong Kong government didn't believe it herself, right? I mean, we had in the book a quote from Carrie Lam sort of early on saying, of course, I know this is not foreign interference, right? She knew, the Hong Kong government knew the mess they had sort of created. But once that sort of confluence happened, right, where you saw American flags on the street, you saw American lawmakers come in the Trump era where so much else was focused on kind of, you know, China and sort of weakening Beijing, right? They just started seeing it only from that lens. And I do think Beijing is, you know, from our reporting, from speaking to people within the Hong Kong government, especially, they really believed it after a 7th. Mm-hmm. They really, truly, truly believed it.
Yeah, and I think another thing, you know, aside from kind of the internationalness and the way to kind of draw, you know, attention to the cause was going out and lobbying. That was a bit different from 2014, right? When Josh Wong was certainly an international figure, but he was on the streets there, right? You know, this time around, the Hong Kongers, I guess, or the movement had its own sort of very fairly sophisticated kind of lobbying operation where they were going out and talking in front of Congress. They were buying ads and newspapers, things like that. I think that was a big part of it. This internationalizing of Hong Kong was something that infuriated the powers to be. And also another point that we kind of see that keeps getting brought up again and again and again now was calling for sanctions. That the protesters and individuals like Judy Lai and other people advocating for sanctions, that certainly now seemed like, given what we know about the national security law trials and statements from the government over the past couple of years, seems like something they would absolutely not tolerate. And so I think there's differences compared to 2014. I think a lot of people focus on, well, it was violent. There was, you know, some vandalism and there's some violence. I think that was different, certainly, and that was, you know, visually alarming, and then there was escalatory actions towards the police. That's, I think sometimes that kind of overshadows this other stuff that we know now Beijing was very, very kind of concentrated on, and Beijing and the Hong Kong government were very focused on and kind of very mad and seemed maybe perhaps even worried about when it comes to sanctions.
So then do you think there was sort of any truth that behind sort of Beijing's populist narrative that there was foreign influence at play? You know, one of the offences in the national security law is collusion with a foreign country or external elements to endanger national security. You know, should Beijing have been worried, or do you think, you know, are the rest of the world sort of going to let Hong Kong not necessarily burn, but just sort of play out as, you know, on its own?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think now, again, it's interesting when we have these discussions, we talk to people like you and other people to kind of look at what the government was saying at the time versus what they're saying now, right? Mm. You know, we know that narrative about foreign interference is not crystallized around August 2019, right? Before that, most of what was coming from the government and from Beijing was that this was an economic issue, right? That people were upset that they couldn't afford apartments, that they had been overtaken by people at Shenzhen. They were living in this great city, looking down on people, you know, from Hong Kong who had no money, who were kind of stuck financially, right? That changed when they started kind of attacking the U.S. government, specifically in the incident that we kind of talk about in the book in some detail. And then we see this kind of big shift with Black Hand Foreign Forces, you know, narrative in a big way. Though it was always floating around, I think, but that's what really kind of crystallized. Now, I think at the time, if you would talk to people, and Carrie Lam herself, as we reported in the book as well, said that she didn't believe this, right? And I think that's we were talking about people kind of like, you know, foreign people, you know, governments giving money to protesters, things like that was kind of what people were, these conspiracy theories that were floating around. Now, I think if you ask people, you know, in government or positions of power about the foreign influence thing, they'll say, well, yeah, because people, you know, because Mike Pompeo sent a tweet, or because some protesters went to Taiwan and met with political parties there. The goalposts have shifted tremendously here. And to kind of explain what they mean by, you know, quote unquote, foreign, you know, interference or foreign meddling, right? Now, if, you know, the U.S. or the U.K. says, oh, you know, they should repeal the national security law, or they're, you know, they fire off a million responses saying that they're interfering in Hong Kong's affairs, right? So the goalposts have changed massively, but then to just kind of like flat out answer your question in terms of this foreign interference, no. You know, this was not, you know, funded by NED or funded by the CIA, or, you know, NDI wasn't there shoveling money in the protesters' pockets. Of course not. And I think they stick with that narrative because it robs the people of Hong Kong of the, you know, autonomy over their own actions, you know, and the belief that they were going out there on their own.
If I could just add like one quick point to that, I mean, I do think that, I mean, all of that is 100% true, but I think that there was a sad thing that now we sort of see in retrospect, which was that, you know, I think a lot of Western governments used Hong Kong, right?
Yeah.
They didn't interfere per se, but they used Hong Kong. I mean, they used Hong Kong as a domestic issue. They used Hong Kong to posture. They used Hong Kong to strengthen their anti-China, you know, credentials or whatever. And then when push came to shove, they really did very little, right? And I think, you know, the UK has probably done the most by offering the BNO pathway. But even then, I think they feel like now that that pathway exists, they can kind of wash their hands, right? And that's it. It's sort of done. And, you know, by the end of when we were finishing up the book, we saw this kind of like flurry of re-engagement, right? We saw this big, you know, bankers conference happen, and not much pushback against that from Washington. You know, we saw the UK, right, the British Consul General saying that there should be no more megaphone diplomacy and there shouldn't be any sort of chiding of Hong Kong publicly and we should be working to re-engage. I think that's you know, a sad reality, right? I mean, that's not the same, obviously, as foreign interference, but I think, you know, there were many, many countries, many politicians, many people who kind of manipulated the Hong Kong issue for their own benefit and it didn't follow through.
So then why do you think Hong Kong is significant? Why should, you know, Washington and London continue to care?
Yeah, because I mean, I think Hong Kong truly demonstrates the fragility of institutions, right? And democratic institutions that we, you know and trust and rely on. And I think that's a message that is global. I mean, one thing, and I was looking back at a passage from our book today, actually, because of the Article 23 stuff that's happening. I mean, I think one thing that people would have never thought would be so compromised in Hong Kong is the legal system, right? Mm-hmm. Common law, you know, British, Canadian judges sitting on the bench, right? I mean, people had so much faith in the Hong Kong legal system. And people had so much faith that even when it became used sort of against political sort of people, right? Like Jimmy Lai or the 47 or whatever, everything would be separated, right? So you could still go ahead and do your like M&A or arbitration or whatever else you want within the Hong Kong courts. I mean, I don't really think even the most strident of Hong Kong defenders believe that today. And I think the sort of pace at which that has happened has been really, really shocking, right? And I think, you know, that's sort of why people should care, right? I mean, Hong Kong was always conceptualized as being this sort of ideal for China, right? In many ways that, you know, even if China would never be fully democratic or open, maybe it would become a bit more like Hong Kong, right? Where there was a certain amount of transparency in doing business, where there was predictability in terms of the rule of law, where there were these institutions that you could rely on and trust. I mean, all of that's gone now.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, something that we learned, if we're looking kind of at, you know, takeaways and things that can maybe be applied, looked at in other places, is kind of a great question of, you know, why do people go along with these things, right? You know, why do people who spoke out at one point stop speaking out? Why do people who were adamantly against one thing suddenly become for it? You know, and go along with these kind of obviously illiberal, you know, anti-democratic things that are taking place. You know, there's a lot of answers to those questions. There's a lot of answers, you know, in Hong Kong. It varies, I think, probably person to person or to group. But I think that's also an interesting thing to think about and kind of interrogate, you know, as to why, you know, politicians and lawmakers or even kind of activists or something, what makes them kind of change and become co-opted when they see these systems that go against kind of their values taking hold in places.
So then I guess my next question is sort of bring it back to the book a little bit. One of the chapters is titled Exiled or Jail. And then thinking about some of the Hong Kong political dissidents, some of them are the sort of main characters in your book, but then of course there's many more. And many of them have ended up either in exile, feeling that they must flee, or directly fleeing sort of arrests and charges against them, or they are in prison. So then what is the next step for Hong Kongers in this situation, do you think?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's like the hardest question of all to answer, right? Some people like Gwyneth Oh have tried to use their position in jail and prison to kind of expose the absurdity of it all, right? I mean, she's one of the few pleading not guilty, even though that's been at a huge personal cost. Chow Hang Tung, obviously, is another one. And they, I think they have sort of become that sort of, you know, like many before them in China, right? Using their position as jailed activists and dissidents to expose something or say something quite profound about the system and have sort of found sort of power in doing that. And that's why it was, I think, so important for us to kind of feature Gwyneth or focus on her in this book. For the people who are in exile, I think so much is about preserving that identity, that sense of, you know, nationhood and community, right? That was birthed on the streets of Hong Kong in 2019. So you see all these initiatives to keep the Cantonese language alive. For example, a lot of universities are starting to do Cantonese programs that have never done it before. You see Hong Kong film festivals, cultural things. There was obviously a very big one in Vancouver quite recently with thousands of people attending. So, you know, I think that's sort of the more like soft side of things. And then obviously people have also, the diaspora have also been very active politically, right? You know, meeting with Westminster and Washington and so on and so forth and sort of push that in some places around the world. You know, the Hong Kong constituent is now big enough that they're actually a voting block, right? In parts of the UK, that's definitely true. In parts of Canada, that's long been true, but now you have a sort of new kind of generation of migrants in, right? And I think, you know, there are more people trying to get involved in local politics and so on. So there are, you know, avenues for optimism, but I think especially today with Article 23 sort of being announced and sort of being more sweeping again than I think people maybe initially predicted, I just think the space in Hong Kong is, slim to none, right?
So then sort of in your book, you divide the three sections into one country, if we burn, you burn with us. And then the third part, I've mixed it up. So it's two systems, one country. So, you know, the basic law, which is Hong Kong's mini constitution, guarantees it's one country with two systems, right? However, the final part of your book is titled One Country. So can you comment on whether or not, to what extent has Hong Kong become one country with China? Are there any sort of distinguishing features to maintain this identity?
Yeah. So I mean, one thing that we share, I guess, that people kind of like to like throw back and you were saying is, you know, it's still freer than, you know, the cities on the mainland. And yeah, that's true. But that shouldn't be the bar that we measure Hong Kong against, right? Hong Kong was different and it still is in a lot of ways different. I can see why it's attractive to people from the mainland to, you know, maybe as we see a lot of immigration to Hong Kong now from the mainland, why they might want to move there, because it is in a lot of ways more open and free than the mainland. But it is undoubtedly a diminished place in every one of those categories, you know, in terms of press freedom, in terms of freedom of speech, in terms of civil liberties, all of that stuff has been massively, massively eroded, right? So again, I think that's kind of a very false metric and bad bar that people like to kind of throw out and measure it against. And in terms of you know, the you know, one country, two systems, I think it's a finished system, right? You know, that it was a grand experiment in governance. I think the people of Taiwan would agree that it's finished. Even the KMT doesn't want one country, two systems now for Taiwan. It's kind of a taboo to even mention it in post 2019 politics there. You know, I think, and then in the eyes of Beijing, it is still working. You know, they still reference it as something that's evolving and in kind of working with it's been being adjusted is kind of the way that they talk about it now, or perfected. So I think it's important to keep that in mind, that they still certainly do think that it's working in some capacity. But I think for anybody else, you know, neutral or outside observers to that, the question is, no, it's not. And it's, yeah.
And I just had this thought, actually, but, you know, when we were doing a lot of the research in our book, it sort of became clear that even when Beijing conceptualized, you know, one country, two systems, they were always very anxious about identity. Like, they were very happy for it to be two systems if the two systems were, like, you know, the currency and maybe even the legal system or like the banking system, blah, blah, blah. But if the two systems meant like two identities, then that was something they were always uncomfortable with, right? Even if you go back to the text from 2003, after Article 23 was shelved, again, very ironic saying this today, there was so much anxiety of that Hong Kong identity sort of developing, right? So as long as they felt that the two systems meant two kind of different ways of seeing yourself or believing yourself, I mean, they would have never been comfortable with it, right? And so that's why now you see this sort of integration of Hong Kong within that Greater Bay Area kind of narrative, where, you know, even if before it might have just been sort of an economic sort of, you know, mega sort of city, right, that they were essentially trying to build. Now that is that subsuming of the Hong Kong identity within that sort of broader sort of southern China or like Guangdong sort of consciousness, right? Or at least that's what they're trying to push. And I think that's a sort of important distinction, right? They're happy with the two systems if the two systems kind of don't get in the way with the one country, right? Essentially.
So then talking more about the new Article 23 legislation, can you comment on, you know, can you predict what's going to happen? Will rights and freedoms and liberties be even further eroded in Hong Kong? Will it become more of one country even?
Yeah, because I think, you know, what we saw today, the text of what is out there, you know, when this was proposed in 2003, Hong Kong and was a different place, but also importantly to remember, China was a very different place. And so the Article 23 that was proposed in 2003, you know, I think seemed drastic at the time, and people said it went even further than did some parts of what was happening in the mainland. You know, look how much China has changed and how much they've become just obsessed with national security, with threats, internal and external, this kind of omnipresent paranoia of the Xi rule. And then you're using that as the basis to write Article 23 now. Obviously, it's going to be far more sweeping, far more reaching than what was seen 20 years ago, right? So that's exactly what we saw today. An expanded definition of state security, state secrets, that this massive section on espionage that I think business is certainly going to be concerned about, that journalists are undoubtedly going to be concerned about, because part of it talks about, you know, expanding the definition of a public servant, right? So someone who would give you maybe an interview or information or a document, you know, puts them at a greater risk now. You've been talking to researchers or journalists or business due diligence types who we've seen detained, on the mainland as of recent. You think the arrival of what it looks like today, it's pretty bleak. And not only is it bleak and draconian, the space to debate or change it is extremely limited. There is no opposition in the legislative council. There's no opposition in the district council. There's no space for protest. You know, a question asked today, I think rightfully so by a journalist, was that is opposing Article 23 against the national security law, right? Think about, you know, just the mind pretzel you have to put yourself in to think about that stuff, you know, in Hong Kong now.
I think it would be interesting to see, like, once they pass this, whether immediately they'll start arresting people under the new law, just kind of like they did with the NSL, right? Just to set up the framework of what it looks like with some, like, show arrests and sort of show trials, right? Which I think, you know, I sort of don't put past them.
And do you think then it will be effective in sort of erosing this national consciousness of what it is to be a Hong Konger, or will it make Hong Kongers more resilient and sort of go underground, do you think?
I think the Hong Konger identity now is sort of easier to kind of express outside of Hong Kong than inside of Hong Kong, right? When we were in Taiwan recently for the election, you know, we went into essentially what were yellow cafes in Hong Kong that were allowed to sort of thrive and function, a strong way, right? I think like that expression, or at least an outward expression of the sort of Hong Kong identity in the way, you know, it was expressed in 2019, it's just extremely difficult to do now, right? I mean, we have friends who say that it's so much easier to just kind of like put your head down and go into survival mode if you're still in Hong Kong, because to do anything else is sort of too painful, right? And I think that's sort of the reality of that dichotomy between exile or staying, right? I mean, not jail, which is kind of a different category, but if you're sort of an average person and you're sort of choosing to stay, or you don't have a choice. It's really difficult to confront every day how diminished the city that you live in is, right? And so I think for a lot of people, they just have to kind of go into like blinker mode and sort of get through it. But, you know,
there's also still a tremendous amount of, you know, fear as well. We've done a lot of, you know, different book events and discussions and things like that. In a couple of months, the book has come out. And, you know, we did one the other day with SOAS in the UK. And every question, every participant who asked a question has to be, you know, anonymous and not tell us, you know, their name. We've been to events at Georgetown Law School in the U.S. where people came out to us afterwards and talked to us, you know, from Hong Kong who didn't want to, again, tell us their surname or didn't want to be photographed at the event because they had family back, you know, in Hong Kong. So there's a huge amount of fear, I think. I think sometimes people have a hard time understanding that because it's not, you know, like an active war zone, or we see, you know, conflicts obviously going on that are much more bloody and horrific. And so sometimes people, I think, kind of have a hard time swearing now. But I think that fear, you know, is very much still out there. It's still very real for a lot of people.
And so then to sort of bring it to a close, do you have any key takeaways from your book and the Hong Kong situation?
I think for me, one of the big ones is, you know, for any movement across the world that sort of relies on US or Western-led support, I mean, they're going to be pretty disappointed, right? That to me was a big takeaway, you know, especially as somebody who grew up outside the quote-unquote West, however you define that. I think for progressive people, especially in Asia, you know, you kind of think like, okay, like all these things that we want, like sort of press freedom or sort of freer speech or kind of more liberal values, whatever, sort of embodied by these, you know, countries, right? I think a lot of people in Hong Kong that we spoke to were very kind of disappointed, right, by the lack of follow through on so much stuff. And to us, that's sort of as important a takeaway as sort of Beijing sort of moved to crush Hong Kong as well, right? And I think that's sort of even true when you look at somewhere like Taiwan, where a lot of Hong Kongers had expectation that they would get residency, that they would be able to stay there, especially considering what a big electoral issue Hong Kong 2019 was for the DPP, really sort of helped bolster Tsai Ing-wen's victory back then, right? I think, you know, that there's just been a lot of disappointment on that front. And that was one takeaway we kind of didn't mention earlier on.
I'm similar takeaways, I think probably from Shivani. I mean, we worked on this whole thing together, and I think, you know, I try to kind of, you know, look at the positives of kind of, you know, what we saw on the streets and the moments of camaraderie and stuff. You know, it's easy to kind of forget about that stuff sometimes. I think one more takeaways is the fragility, I think, of kind of memory, of historical memory here. And what we're watching is the government absolutely trying to rewrite and whitewash what happened, right? Again, I talked about this earlier, this narrative of this, you know, this color revolution. You know, the Hong Kong General Chamber of Commerce wanted an independent investigation of the police, right? I mean, businessmen wanted this, academics wanted this, right? This was a whole society kind of thing, especially when the police violence got really bad. You know, it's important not to forget that and not to forget the truth about what happened, who's responsible, what the reactions were at the time, because there is a wholesale effort by the Hong Kong government, by Beijing, by Chinese state media to kind of, you know, rewrite this entire thing. And they're doing it through the court system as well, the way that they're prosecuting the NSL 47 and Jimmy Lai, to kind of, again, use that to shape their narrative that they'll put down in the history books one day.
Now, Shivani and Tim, I've taken up a lot of your time, but just before you go, we've got one traditional New Books Network question. What are you working on now?
Not another book. Is that really a question? I think we continue to look at sort of China, you know, and how it's sort of power and economic power and other, you know, political power manifests itself across the region. So it's something that I'm still quite focused on.
Working on a little piece about the Hong Kong and Article 23, you know, hopefully that will be out soon-ish. And then, yeah, you know, New Year, so there's always a lot of big goals and stories you want to write. Hopefully you get around to all of them. So we'll see how it goes.
No, that's excellent. I'll definitely check that out. So just to bring the interview to a close, I'm Jane Richards. I've been speaking with Shivani Matani and Tim McLaughlin about their book, Among the Braves. Shivani and Tim, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thanks so much for having us. Appreciate it.